odprti termin Radio Študent.
Let's start in 1915. Hugo Ball, poet, is doing a performance with his Cabaret Voltaire. And then he goes home and later on he writes down that he invented a new verse. And I quote, a verse without words or sound poems in which the balancing of the vowels is gogged and distributed only to the value of the initial line. The accents became heavier, the expression increased, and intensification of the consonant. So his suggestion is, I'm still quoting, with these sound poems, we should renounce the language devastated and made impossible by journalism. Even more, he says, we should withdraw into the innermost alchemy of the word and even surrender the word, in this way conserving for poetry its most sacred domain. So Hugo Ball finds what he believes is a novelty, a poetic expression which will defy every meaning, as any meaning would be solely to perpetuate the destructive conditions presented by, on the one hand, the World War I in Europe and those indicated in hyper-industrialization and consumerist fever in the USA of the first decades of the 20th century. So his suggestion is that all bonds with the expression as we know it need to be cut. Otherwise, we admit that we agree with our own destruction. What needs to be opened is a path for an expression of the unsaid, perhaps even unspeakable, which is such because first, it truly holds no meaning in traditional representations of realities and is for precisely that reason positive. And second, because the cognitive horizons need to be expanded as much as possible in order to trace a possibility of any or even more different future. However, can the desire to surpass existing realities and to create works which are completely distanced from meaning or at least from culturally conditioned associativity up for realization in such an absolute form? That's one of my questions. For one can understand such an attempt as a modernist myth, a sort of a shortcut towards subversiveness, progressiveness, etc. As much as these ambitions to make us understand each stimulus, object, and event in their naked occurrence are attractive, seemingly liberating and perhaps emancipatory, they show little capacity for realization. In sound arts, for example, the basic character of sound, its continuous departure, and at the same time its imminent presence, while avoiding tangible materiality, of course, offers pleasure in an event which can always happen without intention and meaning. But it is precisely at this point where overt carefulness is in order, as absence of intention and aversion towards meaning already are intention and then meaning. For example, when Kurt Schwitters was irritated by Mies van der Rohe's remark that one of the sounds in his poetry sounds like a Romanian word for schnapps, it was precisely that, the artists or intellectuals' desire to exit systems of expression and interpretation which he despises. It was the artist's attempt to expand perception potentials beyond the established ones, and in that sense, it was a palliation, even termination of a relationship with the past. But because of the interactional character of communication, that departure can never really be executed. If I then get somehow stuck with Ball's realization that he invented a new verse, sound poetry, I cannot but ask, did he really? Did he really invent new, where new concerns emphasis and focus on the oral, in that sense also abstract, by no means tangible and explainable? Or is it actually a similar phenomenon to, for example, precarity, which appeared as a grand problem only in the past decades since it is experienced by a large mass of population, but was long before lived by another large mass of population, women, which were, because of their class position, which is precisely the problem, overheard and overlooked. In other words, are the beginnings of sound poetry to be and must be transferred from the early 20th century and from Hugo Ball's hands and seeked for many centuries, even millenniums earlier, and among women poets, for example. Let us consider, for example, women of Greek lamentation, the ancient Greece. Because it was to them that a rather theatrical expression of mourning was allowed, or rather ordered. It was a performance of consequences of a tragedy in everyday life. Women performing lamentations were professional sound artists, and their role was allowed prolonged expression of woe in the name of all whom it concerned, a performative praxis of body machine, so to speak, which, while it is performing, is not in productive function, and yet it is producing something. Of course, we should not fail to notice that the role of women in lamentation was to address the dead, never the living. Women's sonoric expression was delimited to the other side of public spaces. However, it was still a sonoric expression of a mourning poem, the long tones which together formed a kind of a polyphonic composition of emotion that in its performance was also an interpretation. Similar practices can also be found in Balkan cultures, among others. There are the so-called narikace and tužbalke, jaukalice, plakavice, bugarile, as they are called. Women authors and roles and rituals, which are disappearing with urbanization and bourgeois aesthetization of a social etiquette, but might or should still be defined to be sound poetry. Just as in Greek lamentations, we are again dealing with women poets, improvisers who create with their voices. Again, the voice can, or cannot, be activated by equally improvised text, which in its content reminds of a kind of an epic. It glorifies the dead and their triumphs and the inexplicable loss that their death represents. But, I'm not really smoking, so. But at the front of that performance is voice as such, vowels as such. This is a sonoric expression, both long and grand, for the pain, the sensation is also enormous and unstoppable. Most of all, it is, in a way, unspeakable. Death presents itself as that which, because it was not experienced, is impossible to really speak of, but is possible to be imagined as a consequence and lived in proximity of its manifestation. Hence, one can say that mourning poetry is sound poetry, not only in a way that in its manifestation is sonoric, but also in a sense that for its performance it is neither possible nor desired to use established discourses, but it is, on the other hand, needed to use as a discourse which interrupts disruptive and destructive realities. So, along the way, loudness was, at least for the women, replaced with silence. Long before the Catholic commands aim at silencing the women's voice, but certainly hand in hand with tendencies towards moderate social lives, which undoubtedly did not agree with the extreme and the extremely long sonoric performances. With silencing, it was precisely sounding that became the ultimate tactic for emancipation. That poetry is amongst the most vibrant artistic forms with marginal groups such as lesbian communities is not so much of a coincidence as it is urgency. Furthermore, it should not be overlooked that one of the first releases of the one of the earliest and biggest lesbian feminist music labels, Olivia Records, was an album of poetry performed and recorded in 1976 by African-American poet Pat Parker and Judy Grant. It made the latter think about the purpose of such artistic expression, and she sort of summed it up in this affirmative declaration that yes, that is how resistance really sounds. Among other poems on that incredible album is a poem by Pat Parker called "My Lover is a Woman," in which she says, I quote, Then I never think of my family's voices, never hear my sisters say bulldaggers, queers, funny. Come see us, but don't bring your friends. It's okay with us, but don't tell mama, it would break her heart. So her sisters never say a word like a bulldagger, and lesbianism needs to be hidden from parents' sight and ears. That is precisely why the poet needs to say those words which have absolutely no meaning outside lesbian communities and in social conditions in which lesbianism is, so to speak, inexistent. In that sense, her poem is a loud constructive appeal arising from, if I draw from Judith Butler, the awareness that no discourse is adequate here or that our reigning discourses have produced an impasse. So what to her is an adequate, oppressive discourse needs to change. She needs to offer her own discourse, for silence is for her equally unacceptable. In that sense, her poem is not only to be read, but produced as sound making, through which the individual is in a way self-interpolated, subjectivated, and so on. And through that process and through announcement of her presence, she can start to form a collective which will hopefully become a vital political body. Now, performing words such as bulldagger or queer is a formative action for lesbians or lesbian feminist collectives and individuals. It is carried out in poetry which surpasses both presence in the public everyday life and interpretations fixated in that space. In general public space, on the other hand, butch or bulldagger signifies either the inexistent or and the unspeakable, inasmuch the public insists in defining the existent only that which is capable of reproduction. Or, and precisely because of that, it is a secondary or third-class position of an individual. But not when the term is used by a lesbian herself. In that case, it is a subjectivational maneuver, a detailed crafting of a specific layer of identity. Therefore, what a woman or lesbian poet does when she sounds and performs her poem is saying that which, in the dominant sphere, has no meaning or is opposing the established discourses and vocabularies in which she either is or is not marked with derogatory signifiers. So if Hugo Ball proposed a new announcement of language which was destroyed by the dynamics of public media space, it is the poetry of lesbians and feminists which presents a renewal or even first establishment of new language. Then in their essay, Harpsichords, Metallic Howls, Irene Gammel and Suzanne Zelazo write that the work of women in the field of sound poetry was all too little explored, obviously. Then they dig into the life and work of the Dada poet Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven, for whom Jane Heap, the co-editor of the Literary Review, said that she was, I quote, a woman of brains, of mad beauty and elegant wesen, who has abandoned sanity, left it cold. Elsa von Freytag was quite a character. She used to wear spoons for earrings. She was inspired by homosexual camp and equipped herself with feathers. In the then emerging fascination of people with conserved foods and the novelty called a bra, she made a comment on this prosthetic aesthetization and objectivization of women by wearing a tomato can instead of a bra. She was pretty cool. But then she killed herself. So many women modernists did so. That she cut her hair in the style of the New Woman and that her poems provoked waves of outrage surely needs not be especially emphasized. So then when Jane Heap writes that Elsa von Freytag abandoned sanity, she is actually bowing to the poet. As it is the society which has, in perspective of modernists, abandoned sanity, the poet's doings are not only a bounce off the general social sphere, but a turn, a sort of a construction of survival in the core of absolute madness. Not she, but the dominant has lost its mind. In that sense, she pokes fun at the dominant, she provokes it and pokes its entire moderateness in a way, as well as that of the early modernists. She does that through sonority, which is in the core of her interests and is both her interpretational and creative platform. She writes to Juna Barnes, who supported her greatly. She says, "Never could I help liking your name, Juna. I was disturbed by it, for you know how I judge by sound." But the reverse relation might be worth pointing out, the being judged by sound, where sound or sound making also mean absence of sound or sound making, as silence is only a form of sonority. The poetic sound making, if sound poetry can be defined in those terms, hits the history of residing in silence. It questions both history and silence, therefore loosening its absoluteness. And in that process, the history of sound making reveals itself as a constitutive element of a building that seems to never have been built. So in that sense, to recognize sound poetry with women or lesbian authors before the 20th century and in generous situations and forms which precede Hugo Ball's innovation means revealing precisely that building. Therefore, what my proposal is, what needs to be done as a suggestion from a feminist perspective, or sociological for that matter, is to broaden strongly the definition of sound poetry. Strongly. In a way that when thematizing women and or lesbian poets, we recognize soul sonority as already subversive and emancipatory in that sense. And as a permanent presence of a subject. I really like what a music philosopher, Salome Wegelin, explained. She said, "Sound is the performance of production that uses the permanence of the monument and discards it by gliding over its form to produce its own formless shape. For women and or lesbians, artists, sounding poetry represents also an ineradicable mark of one in space, a history and a future where both are a continuous present. What becomes is perhaps an invisible presence, even more invisible with departure of a body, which still becomes a body, a sounding, active, vital, and disruptive body precisely through sounding." Now, questions regarding sound poetry are relevant, perhaps to a feminist perspective, among other reasons, as questions of authorship. The abyss between the author and performer can be annulled in sound poetry. There is no longer an awkward, superficial transfer of knowing, and there is no more friction between the author and her who interprets the work of the other, thereby creating an entirely new piece of art and seemingly driving the author away from her own work. The question, whose voice are we listening to when we are listening to sound poetry? This relatively common musicological question in the context of music leaves but little doubt when the work is performed by the author herself. But when there is another performer between the concept and the performance, in short, when poetry is written and handed over to a performer to recite it, a transfer of authorship from author to performer is at work. The listener might know who the author of the work is, but the source of sound which materializes the poem is transferred elsewhere through its performance to the performer, who then in acoustic sense shares authorship, the so-called acoustics of authority, with the author, of course. It is not that shared authorship, as perceived by the listener, is problematic, of course, but that the declaration of authorship has emancipatory and interpretational effects. For example, you probably know her, when sound artist Katalin Ladik, in one of her poems, declares that she is a two-gendered being, the authorship and presence of her body are relevant on at least three levels. First, because it reveals her appropriation of the male gender, precisely the gender which makes her other, and allows her to dismiss gender hierarchies. Second, because only as an author of the poem and of making the poem resound can she be subjectivated into what she sounds. And third, because her performance alludes to urgency of listening from her very class position, where an intensely erotic sound making comes from, that which through the author exceeds traditional narrations and motives. So the author's sound poetry is her sort of an intersubjective rhythm and frequency, in a way, which because of her gender difference is asymmetric, atonal, and threatening to social order in itself. By sounding herself, this eroticized machine, she disassembles both imperative character of reproduction as the only sense and drive of society and discourses, which argue for and maintain this production system. A sound poet is both a creator and a performer. She radiates sounds which are poetry, but such which cannot be put to any meaning, if that is what yesterday's questions were about when Jan was giving a lecture. They cannot produce any meaning within the established discourses. Even more, the author is polyphonic in a way, even though she is one. I would suggest you to listen to Katalin Ladik's album Phonopoetica. Unfortunately, we cannot do it here. It's an amazing album from 1976. In this album, is really only one of many cases of exchange of traditional sounds with vocal microparticles, as Henri Chopin called them. But if a word, as a convention, was replaced with what appeared to be meaningless sound particles a long time ago, with the invention of magnetophone and even before with Dada poetry and even before La La La, that practice is, as shown, possible to trace long, long before among women authors who, despite the risk of their sound making being interpreted as non-speech, as meaningless babble, persist and by doing so contribute to abolishment of authority, which founds itself in precisely incapability to understand and in endless search for knowledge. So sound poetry was here long before it was discovered by authority. It was there among women and or lesbian poets, lamentators, sound artists.